not even 30 years old. We don't have kids. Why not take the, I enjoy this investing side, this business side of things more. And it was more like, if 10 years from now, if I don't do this, will I have regrets? So I decided to leave the pharmacy world and do real estate full time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Moeller Real Estate and Business Podcast. I'm your host, Phil Moeller, and on this podcast, we will be interviewing guests that have made their mark in real estate, in business, and in other areas of life. Listening to podcasts myself has helped me in so many different ways and continues to do so. If you're a real estate investor or an entrepreneur or aspiring to be either, or just someone that wants to learn, you've come to the right place. An easy way to have an impact is to share this episode with friends or family, provide a review, or just spread the word. We greatly appreciate it, and now let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Moeller Real Estate and Business Podcast. Very excited for today's guest. Today we have Dylan Cook, local to me, Dylan Cook. Dylan grew up in St. Mary's, Ohio. He now lives in Cincinnati. Dylan, how are you doing today, man?
I'm doing well, man. I'm happy to be here.
Well, it's great to have a local person on the podcast. I greatly appreciate it. A lot of our listeners are very, very familiar with where you are from. For our listeners, Dylan has a pharmacy background. He was in the pharmacy world for some time. I'm sure he'll talk about that. But now he is the owner of Morning Brew Properties. He's in Cincinnati. He's a real estate investor. He wholesales, flips, buys, and holds. Also has some Bitcoin, I know, so we'll maybe get into that a little bit. He is an expert that has maybe nudged me to make some hopefully good decisions for the long term. But Dylan, so I want to talk about your backstory first a little bit and just how you arrived to where you are today. What brought you to what your focus is?
Yeah, no. So I guess I'll start with, obviously, like you mentioned, from St. Mary's, Ohio, which is a traditionally, pretty quote unquote small town for the first 18 years of my life. And it was very much the, I guess, rich dad, poor dad kind of dynamic where I was just raised to get good grades, go to college, get a good career, work for a single employer. And that's what I thought I was doing. So that's basically what I did. I was a good student at high school. I finished in the, I don't know, top 10 or so in my class, went down to Cincinnati and decided to pursue a pharmacy degree, graduated in 2017. So it was a 6-year program at that time. And then I basically was going to climb the corporate ladder. So I started as a floater pharmacist, got my own store, and then I was actually promoted to manager Kroger when I was 25, maybe I was 26, which was pretty young to have that kind of a role inside of a Fortune 500 company. So, but during that time, I guess backing up a little bit, as I was probably midway through pharmacy school, the concept was, I'm going to make a decent amount of money. I should know what to do with it. And so I just started reading personal finance books, everything I get my hands on. And once I kind of latch onto something, I tend to go very deep into it. And when you learn about business and personal finance, it's a rabbit hole that basically never ends, right? And so I started at Dave Ramsey, which was just like, I'm gonna pay off all this debt, et cetera, et cetera. And then I read Rich Dad Poor Dad basically the year I was graduating, because as a floater pharmacist, like I mentioned, you're a lot of time in the car because you're going all over the city. So I was just doing podcasts, audiobooks, the whole nine yards. And so I had this, do I pull the Dave Ramsey route? And you do those compound interest calculators, your IRAs, and it's like, okay, yeah, I mean, I'll have a pretty comfortable life, but I'll be 65. And, or I can go this route where I can maybe have this freedom a little earlier in life, or, be wealthy earlier in life. And so I basically did the 180 and started to take on debt, got into real estate. But I'll pause there, ask if you want to follow up questions, but I can dive into it when we've on our first.
Well, it is interesting you talk about Dave Ramsey and Rich Dad Poor Dad, because two differing like styles and approaches, but I think both have their place for depending on who the person is. So, I mean, do you agree with that? Like, who would you direct towards Dave Ramsey? Who would you direct towards Robert Kiyosaki and Rich Dad Poor Dad?
Yeah, so Dave Ramsey is probably the general population, really. So someone who needs a plan, who's maybe bad with money. I like his saying. I think he says, personal finance is 80% head knowledge and 20% behavior, or other way around. Sorry. Yeah. Other way around. 80% behavior, 20% knowledge.
Yep.
And so just someone who needs a plan, don't get into credit card debt. Don't take out a vehicle that depreciates in value. Whereas the Robert Kiyosaki thing is he's just more involved in buy assets. This is his overall thing. An asset defined as something that pays you to own it is in the simplest definition that I can give,
So
right?
I think maybe the way to think about it is if you're like just you said it at the beginning of that response, but if you're just not very disciplined with your finances, if you have a lot of poor behavior around your finances, you probably need to take the David Ramsey approach first. Because honestly, if you take the Robert Kiyosaki approach, but you're bad with finances in the first place and you're not doing what Dave Ramsey said, the Kiyosaki approach can probably be pretty dangerous for you actually if not done correctly. But if you really have the foundation down, if you're good at saving, if you're good at kind of putting money away and investing or whatever it might be, then Rich Dad Poor Dad, I think, is a great next step.
Totally agree. And like my parents had more of a Dave Ramsey approach my whole life. So I resonated with that first. But I remember being in the car and be like, almost kind of angry because I'm like, I didn't know this other world even existed. Right. And so I just dove deep and I graduated pharmacy school 2017 with negative $72,000 net worth, 24 years old, 2017. Fast forward to today, it's a seven-figure net worth. So I'll just leave it at that. So it was, but I only could do that because of the risk I was taking. But at the beginning, man, I mean, being 24 years old with that pharmacy salary, it did play some advantages because I was very lendable. So I could go to the banks and get these, these
Yep.
down on these rentals.
Well, and I think it's interesting for anyone that wants to take on debt that you can get good debt because of your income too. So there's also this discussion of when do you, how long you have a job, all those other things. Before we get into any of that though, so you graduated 2017, you go into the pharmacy field. Kind of what are the first few years of that look like?
So as I was paying down debt, working overtime, continuing to learn, I think it was the ABCs of Real Estate. It might have been the first real estate book that I read by Ken McElroy. And I basically contacted a realtor that was at my gym. I didn't know any better, but I decided I was going to house hack. So I just took, and then I bought a duplex in an area called Oakley down here, lived in one unit, rented out the other. FHA down payments are 3.5% down. And I just started to basically live for free because the other side covered all of my expenses. And at that point, I could save even more money. And so it kind of started to snowball on itself. I did have a partner from pharmacy school that was very kind of like-minded. So we decided to team up at the beginning. We ended up just doing the 25% down method. We didn't know what the BRRRR method was at the beginning. We got up to like 13 units. Just from simply saving a ton of money and buying these places. That we can talk about this if you want, but that partnership actually ended up splitting around 2019. So we sold everything. So now I'm back down to 0 units, have some cash that I used, eliminated all of my personal debt. And then that's when I just kind of decided, well, pharmacy is kind of getting worse and worse as far as like the day job is concerned. I had met my future wife at that point, and it was like, I'm not even 30 years old. We don't have kids. Why not take the, I enjoy this investing side, this business side of things more. And it was more like, if 10 years from now, if I don't do this, well, I have regrets. So I decided to leave the pharmacy world and do real estate full time.
I think this is safe to say, though. You're expecting. I meant to text you this. You're expecting. Is that right?
That is correct. Yeah, baby girl due in September.
So I guess tell me if that's not public yet because it's about to be, but I can wait maybe to put it
No, it
out.
is
So
not. We just posted it on social media channels like last week. So,
awesome. Congratulations on that. Tell me. So, share what you will, but partnership split, which sounds to me like, you don't have to get into the details of what that was, but you have 17 doors, I think you said, a big step back to zero. Setbacks. What did you learn from that? And what was the result of that continued pain or growth ultimately through that process?
yeah. So the reason for the split, just the quick and dirty, is we had complementary skill sets. It was not like we enjoyed the same things. And so it wasn't really a good partnership where we were both good at the same thing and both bad at the other. And the more dividing factor was we had a misalignment of where we wanted to go, right? So he, and we're still friends, still amicable, all that, but he had a vision to do, other partnerships, more commercial side of things with another partner. I did not have that same vision at the time, so we just decided that it was best to end it and move forward.
Nice. So what did you, I mean, so that's a big step back and now you've kind of progressed and moved forward. Is that going well for you, life
Right.
after that?
Yeah. So now, we're back up to 41 units individually. All of that has come from 2022, really. So the past
Wow.
2 years. And that's the Burr method. And honestly, I've learned to make through flipping and wholesaling a lot more active income. Pharmacy degree was, you start out high, but it's almost plateaued, right? You're not getting those exponential increases. Whereas doing this and creating my own business, your active income can be a lot higher and more exponential. And it's just plowing that back into the real estate. And as we can talk about the Bitcoin too.
So first of all, a couple of just, thoughts. One, 41 doors in 24 months or so is pretty incredible. But I suspect the lessons you learned to build the 17 units and just how to do things was huge. If you were starting brand new, that would have been much more difficult.
Absolutely. Yeah. I could already underwrite. The only thing I really had to learn was sourcing the deals myself. Everything else I kind of knew.
And I think the other thing that haven't really talked about is wholesaling and flipping. And to me, wholesaling is a bit of a grind. I would say it's a very active, if real estate is a spectrum of active to passive income, the most passive is you just give your money away and let someone do all the work versus, wholesaling and flipping are pretty active and you're a combo of, doing that very actively along with holding some real estate, which is semi-active, semi-passive, I would say. But wholesaling, maybe just explain that a little bit. And I have the opinion that if you become a good wholesaler, which means you know how to source and find deals, it can be really powerful for the long term because you learn sales and marketing and things like that. So tell me what wholesaling is and if you think that's true.
So yes, I mean I do think that's true. It's very active, but wholesaling is essentially sourcing the deals yourself, direct the seller through a variety of marketing channels, and you get a contract, line up on a piece of real estate, and the wholesale part is then you find a different end buyer for, let's say you get a property under contract for 100,000, you go to an end buyer, they agree to accept an offer for 110,000. So you just basically collect the finder's fee or the spread between those two numbers for being the deal finder and giving it to an end buyer.
And I think for people that really, if they don't have access to capital early on, but they want to do the grind and the hustle and they're willing to do it themselves, wholesaling is an area where you don't need a lot of money to be successful at it. Is that right?
That is true because you're never actually taking title when you assign a contract. So the answer is yes. If you're willing to drive for dollars or cold call on your own, you can do it with very low money down. My counterpoint to that, if you want to do it at any kind of scale, you have to put some money behind it. And that's not really towards the real estate, that's towards the marketing dollars, some
Yeah.
VAs, kind of the business aspect of that.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute and maybe whether that's for real estate or just general business. What are some different tools or resources? You mentioned VAs. We haven't talked a lot about that, and VAs are available to anyone, but so what are some things you're doing that are maybe unique from what people are familiar with?
So I'd say the things that are unique would be, I mean, we use a lot of the same softwares that people do. People who listen to this might be familiar with PropStream, or REI Sift. So basically, we pull these lists from public data. We can list stack them by different, they call them vexations, but they're different motivations. So like, are they high equity landlord, or do they have a past bankruptcy? Are they in foreclosure on their house? Divorces, inherited properties, probate. They go all through these kind of scenarios, and you basically market to these people that says, hey, interested at your house at 123 Main Street. And what you're pitching is the convenience, right? Instead of doing the realtor fees, the closing costs, the inspections, the timeline that it takes, we can come in, give you a cash offer, and kind of move on from there. And I guess the other things that we use that might be different. We had a software guy make a bot for us. So like instead of using PropStream, which everybody can have because it's just a paid software, you can go into your local jurisdiction, they can run what's called a web scraper, and you can get some of these leads a lot earlier than a lot of other people can. So speed to lead is actually a very important determination factor in this business.
And
So that's one thing that we might do differently.
I think you can do those types of things software just in any business. The other thing is, so virtual assistants. I mean, do you have a virtual? What does that
I
look
have
like?
two right now. So one is basically a full-time cold caller. So if you get a postcard from us with the number, you call in, you're actually going to talk to that VA first. So she's the one that's qualifying those leads. And then she also has like a half responsibility of, okay, within our CRM, which is RE Simply, we have like 250 leads. Then she goes through and follows up with these leads on a specific cadence, right? So they're brand new. They basically get a call or a text daily for 10 days. But sometimes you reach these people and they're interested in selling, but they might not be really inside for 4, 6 months, maybe 2 years. And you want to be top of mind when this person does decide to sell. So you all we have she goes through and follows up with these leads on specific cadences based on the conversations that we've had previously with that seller.
Nice. But so for virtual assistants in general, what for any business, what are some different tasks that a business owner, a real estate investor, whoever it would be, can leverage? I mean, you talked about really what I heard is sales and marketing. Are the main ones? Is there some others?
Yeah, I mean, you can do all, like, I know me personally, I don't have this, but I know people who use it for basically all of their finances. So bookkeeping, admin, so like checking your email, screening your emails. Data scraping is another big one. Instead of pulling the list, they'll do that. A lot of Excel formatting, things that kind of can be stepped out in a checklist type manner. A lot of VAs are very good for that type of work.
Yeah, and I think there's a balance there of like I like hiring, having people in the office, supporting local kind of, there's all the benefits of that, but at the same time there's some, if there's really tactical things that are being done or just repetitive over and over again, there's opportunities to hire people from the Philippines or wherever it might be that can do a really good job, are very well educated in these different things. So just something for people to think about. I want to shift gears a little bit because I know, and I don't know when this started, but Bitcoin, which as of this recording, Bitcoin is right around $70,000 or so per coin. Dylan and I have had some discussions in the past couple of years about this, including when it was at $20,000 or so. It said it's going to be a roller coaster, it's going to go up and down, but the fundamentals are strong. So, like really basic, Dylan, like what is Bitcoin? Because people just hear about it, but what
Yep.
is Bitcoin at the most basic level? Help me understand it.
So yeah, this can go a thousand different ways, but I'll try to do this as simple as I can. When Bitcoin was, first invented back in technically 2008, the software was released in 2009. That was the whole introduction to crypto and blockchain and like this hype cycle that's kind of gone up and down throughout the years. But what Bitcoin is what I would say is a return to sound money, which is like a hard asset. So I like to do the digital gold narrative because if you understand that the history of really the world monetary policy, but the US monetary policy, we were on a gold standard until 1971, right? Every dollar was supposed to be backed by gold that was underneath Fort Knox or somewhere in the world, right? But when Nixon took us off that, we were on a pure fiat monetary standard, right? And so that's like 2008 is another good example where they thought quantitative easing, which is the banks printing money, was going to cause all this inflation, et cetera, et cetera. What Bitcoin tries to do is give us a return to sound money without the need of a centralized party like the Federal Reserve, the US Treasury, because it's decentralized. It's operated by node operators who are all over the world. I'll stop there. You want to ask a follow-up question or?
So the way I mean, first of all, the big hang up for me is that it's a digital currency only. So like I
Correct.
can't hold what, and I don't like I can't I can hold a dollar bill. I can hold a coin, like a quarter. It still doesn't feel physical to me. It's just digital.
So I guess what the hang up there, and a lot of quote unquote gold bugs have the same hang up. And this is where the technology aspect comes a little bit more because it's the encryption behind it. And if people want to nerd out on this, it's called SHA-256. But you can, because of cryptography, you can actually prove the amount that you quote unquote own on the blockchain that nobody else owns. So most digital things, like if I were to send you a picture of my phone, you could copy and paste that and go out a million miles, like you could send anybody you want, right? And that's the whole thing of digital. And so what Bitcoin solves and the blockchain solves is what's called digital scarcity. And so, how do you have something that's digital that's also scarce? And that's the reason behind that is because of the encryption and the node operators around the world, and then the mining that goes into that, which, if you add up all the energy it uses, like all the joules that are entered and the megawatts, it's actually the largest like backed computer system in the world.
So I want to talk about a couple of things that I've heard you say or ask questions and just let you explain it. So if you can't tell, Dylan knows this stuff and he's like, he is a very strong believer of Bitcoin long term, or I think crypto and Bitcoin specifically, you can correct that. But the basic understanding like that I tell people is like, so just talk about supply demand of this. Talk about
Yep.
supply demand of Bitcoin, and I think that's the main driver of your belief in it. If I'm missing that, you can correct that as well.
No, so I mean, just like any asset, same thing with real estate, with gold, supply and demand is like the number one rule, right? And to back up what you said, I actually am like a Bitcoin only believer. I don't hold anything else in the crypto world. I'm not saying there's not legit. I just don't know that world very well, because Bitcoin is trying to solve the money problem, and there are things that are trying to solve other problems, like supply chains and file storage and all this kind of stuff that I don't have the education on. But when the protocol was released, there's only ever going to be 21 million Bitcoin. There's a supply cap. So you compare that versus the US dollar or any fiat currency, where the people in charge can just press Control P on a printer and print infinite amount of money. You can't do that with Bitcoin, no matter how much that you own. That's the difference between what's called proof of work and proof of stake, where proof of work is you have to actually exert energy to mine another Bitcoin, whereas proof of stake is kind of like our current political system, where the more that you own, the more voting rights that you have, right? And so, okay, there's only ever going to be 21 million, and that's protocol driven. The supply chain, or the way the supply issuance is it was very much at the beginning. So every 10 minutes, a new block is mined. And at the beginning, it was 50 Bitcoin per block. And every 4 years, that gets cut in half. So keep in mind,
Okay.
we did this in 20, 2009 is when it first started. We've already had 90% of the issuance already done. And we're at 6.5 issued Bitcoins every 10 minutes in this current, they call it an epoch. And actually, in a timely manner, April 20th is supposed to be what's called the next halving event, whereas issuance gets cut in half again. And if you follow the supply chart that, or the price chart from previous halvings, you would think that in the next 12 to 18 months post that, we have a very big run up in price. And that's just following historical price patterns. And the only other caveat I'll throw on top of that is it's getting more and more adoption, less career risk for people who manage money. You're seeing BlackRock, Fidelity, ARK, all of these major financial institutions now issue ETFs. They're mining it, they're buying it. So now, if you're a financial advisor 10 years ago, if you would advise Bitcoin, they'd have laughed you out of the room. Now it's like, okay, we're actually, this can be part of a portfolio, maybe 1 to 2%, but you're still getting those outsized returns without any of the massive volatility that is normally associated with the asset.
So demand, you're talking a little bit, you're getting into the demand. So I want to talk about that more and like the usage rate. And the other thing is I think about Bitcoin, and maybe this is wrong, but from my perspective, and maybe this is narrow-minded, Bitcoin feels like an investment vehicle, not a used product like the dollar is. So talk about the demand maybe in those two contexts.
There's a really good podcast that I'll show real quick. It's called Robert Breedlove runs it. It's called What Is Money? And the very first podcast that he does talks about this. And it's a question that sounds like trivial, and it's like, what do you mean? Like, what is money? But it actually, if you look at the history of money, it actually has certain properties, which is why gold ended up being the reserve currency for a while, because it's durable, you can transport it, et cetera. All that being said, is Bitcoin, in my view, is first going to be solved the store of value problem, right? I feel like most people in the world can feel inflation a lot today in today's day and age, right? Things are getting pricier and pricier. If you ask an economist, they'll be like, oh no, inflation was only 2%, not telling you that that was the rate of change and that prices are still going up, they're just going up slower, right? And so you're first solving the store of value function. So a good analogy is real estate. Take your $100,000 house, $200,000 house 10 years ago, price in Bitcoin, it would have been 500 Bitcoin. Price it today, and now it's 10 Bitcoin, right? So your denominator is actually getting lower if you decide to save in Bitcoin instead. Now, there are, because of the way it works, the first layer cannot be the Visas, the Apple Pays, the instant like medium exchange that people use, right? However, there are technologies, Lightning being one, Liquid being another, and they're called layer two solutions that kind of can do the medium exchange problem, right? So you and I could hold up a QR code and we could exchange instantaneous value without the need of the Visas, the Apple Pays. There's no intermediary between those things. So, but that technology is not ready yet. So I think it's only a matter of time before you start seeing merchants starting to use this in an adopted fashion. But it's a bottom up phenomenon, whereas most currencies, think about it, have always been top down. It's your government saying, this is the way we're going to do it, not an emergent phenomenon like a new technology.
And there will be a mix of people. Some people then, I guess if I go back to my question, will be using Bitcoin as an investment vehicle and not wanting to use it that much because the value will go up. But there's also this pool of users that want to use it to transact on a regular basis. What, so that, and then what is the growth rate of the demand of Bitcoin?
So I can't give you percent, but I know it's like a hockey stick. I know it's exponential. And the reason for that is some of those big players I mentioned earlier are finally entering the space. And they, I mean, and if you look at the past, since those ETFs were approved a couple of months ago, they have a couple billion dollars worth.
Oh, wow.
And there's actually one company right now, and I think you'll see more of this. It's called MicroStrategy, who are actually replacing their company's balance sheet with Bitcoin instead of US Treasuries or instead of other corporate-backed bonds, right? So if you're a new CFO and you're seeing this, actually, you can go look up their stock price since they started doing this, and it's up, I think, 8x. So I think that's going to catch the attention of other CFOs around the country and be like, well, why don't we start doing this?
So
And it's
how,
going to feedback on itself.
so I've also, there's also all these Bitcoin wallets and other stuff. And I don't, again, I don't know this stuff well. So like what I did personally is I have a little bit of Bitcoin, or sorry, a little bit of my investments, a small percent in a fund with
Okay, yeah.
people that I trust that know what they're doing. But if people want to get into Bitcoin or crypto, there's all these different wallets. It feels really risky if you do it wrong. Is that true?
So if you're not a techie person and you don't want to learn it, go to like the Coinbases, the Krakens, like these bigger exchanges that are one SEC approved, and it's just like opening a Charles Schwab Vanguard account. There's not really any difference outside of that.
Okay.
Now, there is a thing in the Bitcoin world called self-custody, where you can basically get your own what's called a hardware wallet, and you can keep that, in a safe, in a safety deposit box hidden somewhere, which is equivalent of you having gold bars in your home in a safe, right? It's kind of the same thing. But the risky part there is it's protected by a passphrase. And if you lose that passphrase, you're kind of SOL,
Yeah.
right?
What
And
were
so
the
that's the
two
risky part.
like more fun type like Schwab or the
So
Schwab
Coinbase is the most
Coinbase?
popular. I'm sure people have heard of that. And the other one that I've used personally, again, not a recommendation, is called Kraken.
Okay. And what is Bitcoin? Last question, and then we'll move on. Just one
Yeah.
word answer. In 2030, what will a Bitcoin be worth?
2030. So that
Sure.
means two halving cycles from now. Yeah, I'll put myself out here. I'd be surprised if it's not at seven figures.
Okay, you heard it here. Maybe not first. Dylan is a very smart guy. He knows his stuff. This is not formal investing advice. We're not vouching for this. You take your own risk. You do your own thing. But if you put a little bit of money in something that does that, then you maybe on the other hand, if that happens and this is where you learned it first, don't forget about me someday is what I
Yeah.
should say to the listeners. I want to circle back to your story a little bit, Dylan. So what are you up to today? Like, what are you excited about?
Yeah, so I think I'm the definition of a hustlepreneur, which is not necessarily a good thing, but I've generated a lot of The most recent success with the portfolio and the business income, basically from just working a lot. And also networking, I've gone to almost every meetup I could in the past 5 years, so I know a lot of people in my local market. And that's been, I would be lying if I said the people I know didn't have a big factor, but I need to be more of a business owner instead of just a hustlepreneur. And that's going to be my focus moving forward. I have some of those pieces in place already. The bookkeeper, the VA, I just gave over two-thirds of my portfolio to a management company, right? So I'm starting to outsource some stuff. But as I, like you mentioned earlier, I'm going to become a father here soon. And I want to be a more not the business not run so much on me.
Yeah, you get the hustle in now because you're gonna be hustling with lack of sleep here soon, Dylan.
Yeah,
So,
right.
but that's very exciting. What would you say as we wrap up here, kind of near the end? But like, if you talked about some key factors to your success at a pretty darn young age, quite frankly, I was trying to do the math, but
31.
31. So, what would be your key factors to success that you could guide others with?
I would say never stop learning. I always try to stay humble and keep reading, keep doing podcasts, keep trying to educate myself on things that I want to be educated on, whether that be monetary policy, real estate, et cetera. And then just perseverance. There are times where, especially at the beginning when I left that, low six-figure job, I'm like, what the hell did I just do? But if you just don't give up and you honestly just keep trying, eventually you will find some success.
Awesome. I love that. And on the never stop learning, it sounds like, I mean, the other thing you said, reading. So read, educate, podcasts are your sources of learning. And then also the networking thing, which you said prior, like hustlepreneur, but just networking and going to events. Maybe I want to ask more about that. And those local, like, how. Give some, is there any tangible examples of just some things that have happened through those local events or just being a networker in general that have come your way?
I mean, I would almost everything, like the lenders I use today, the contractors I use today, a lot of the end buyers that I have, that I send deals to come from that. The bookkeeper I use, it's hard to say, or even some of the private money that I have now for some of the deals. So I almost every aspect of my real estate business, I have the people I use and rely on today have come from networking.
And I think it's just because I think part of that is you could, like, if there's lenders, contractors, buyers, private money people there, you can build trust and rapport with them. Basically, you get to know them. Okay, I trust this person's character. Like, that's who you want to do, like, do business with people that you know, like, and trust. And if you're going to events and you're getting to know people, it's going to accelerate that.
Yeah, no, 100%. And if you, I think if, the more you show up too, and they're like, and I'm not a huge social media guy, but if you're like, hey, I'm doing this, and people know about it, they can see it, I think that helps build some of that trust.
What about like what do you think moving forward? You talked a little about shifting to business owner. What's going to be a key factor to your success moving forward and getting to that, more business owner, top level business owner?
Two things is I need to dial in my KPIs so I'm tracking the right stuff, which will allow me to make more informed decisions on where to hire, what marketing channels to continue to, push or crank up the dial on. And then outside of that is going to be people. So my next hire will probably be an acquisitions person, someone that can talk to the sellers, go on the seller appointments, develop that rapport, but can also, have the same run business the way I want it to be run. And that way I'm not driving all over the Cincinnati where I should be probably more behind the computer making decisions.
Nice. What about so education, books, or podcasts? What has been the most impactful business or real estate book or podcast that you've read or listened to?
Good question. I think so my life changed when I first learned the Burr method, and then for the velocity of money. So I read the Burr book, but I probably learned about it first from the one of the beginning Bigger Pockets podcast. And I don't know if it has the same ROI today, because it's changed a lot since not that first episode. But I would say that was probably the biggest shift when I learned that I didn't have to put 25% down on all the property that was buying.
By the way, Burr method is buy, rehab,
Rents, or
rent,
sorry, buy, rehab, rent, refinance, repeat.
refinance, repeat.
Yeah.
And that I did that on our third property, and it was like, oh, now I don't need to fund every single one of these. I can go a little bit faster. So that was a big changer, game changer for me. Can you explain real quick, like, what does velocity of money mean?
Yeah, so it's basically how quickly can you turn over capital to redeploy is how I view at it. And so a lot of people will say that's like return on invested capital too. But so if you have a $100,000 house, you need to put 25% down to buy it. You're out of pocket 25 grand. Well, now you have to save up another 25 grand just to buy the next property. Whereas if you can burr it, so now you're buying that $100,000 place for 50,000. You're putting 25,000 into it with, maybe private money, whether that be hard money or private money. And then you go to the bank, they say it's worth 100, 125,000. They'll give you a loan for 75% of the value. So they're writing you a check for 75 to 100 grand. So you're basically out of pocket now for nothing. And you can do that basically until your other resources are out, until you have the other contractors and stuff.
And if
So.
you can recycle that money quickly with good debt in place that's paying you because you're cash flowing from the property, that's where real velocity can
Correct.
happen
Yeah.
and compounding can happen. What about most impactful personal development book?
I think The Go Giver. Try to read that book at least once a year.
The Go Giver is fantastic. We actually just had Bob Berg, who wrote it, on
Oh,
our
did you
podcast.
really?
Yeah, he's and honestly, he's a really good guy. So he did
I
the
didn't know that was gonna hurt
podcast.
you. That was not a cheat.
And I'm pointing to it, but then he also, like, just, to support what he does, he wrote like a handwritten note to me, like, to, I don't even know how he found our address. I gotta look into that a little bit, but like a handwritten note to us just saying thanks for having me on, stuff like that. So he's living the mindset, and I that's in my top five on a regular basis. And I think if you have that, like, what I'm excited about for you, Dylan, is if you have that mindset and you're serving people and you're giving to them, that's probably, by the way, why this networking event has been so impactful for you. Because if you're going there and you're serving and you're helping others, people are looking for ways to serve you and help you back, and that's probably what's led to a lot of your success. So, congratulations on building that mindset, which isn't just automatic, and building it and the success that you've gotten because of it.
I appreciate that, man. That means a lot, especially coming from you.
Where, Dylan, how can people find out more about you?
Yeah, just type in my name, Dylan. Last name is Cook, but spelled KOCH on any social media platform, and I should pop right up.
Awesome. Dylan, thanks so much for coming on. Thanks for educating us on a lot of different topics, real estate and Bitcoin. I do hope it keeps going up and to the right, even if it's staggered. But I really do, even though this is a real estate and business podcast, I just thought it'd be a great opportunity because of how much you know about Bitcoin too. So I appreciate that. For everyone, this is the Mueller Real Estate and Business Podcast, signing off. Thank you for listening to the Mueller Real Estate and Business Podcast. We hope you found today's episode helpful. If you know current or aspiring investors or entrepreneurs or anyone that would benefit from today's episode, we appreciate you sharing it with them, or better yet, providing us a 5-star review. To learn more about Mueller Real Estate, visit our website at www.muellerre.com. You can also sign up for our newsletter or local events via our website. In closing, I encourage you to be purposeful in all areas of life. Educate yourself, network with others that have been successful, take action, and lead. Thank you.